This is Seattle's Morning News. I'm Aaron Granillo, filling in for Dave Ross. We have been talking a lot these days about what it will take to get kids back to school, but getting them back for in-person learning means getting school buildings pandemic ready. Joseph Allen is director of the Healthy Buildings Program at Harvard University's School of Public Health, and he argues that schools can reopen and furthermore should reopen. And he now joins us on the line. Good morning, Joseph.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Here in Washington State, in our region, nearly half of all students could be learning online when fall comes around because the districts here have already decided to do fully online learning. Are you arguing that leaders in these districts and individual schools are making the wrong call?
Well, look, I mean, I think as a country, we have failed dramatically with our responses to coronavirus, and nothing is more in our face than the fact that we can't get children back to school in August and September. We have had many months to now prepare. We should have been preparing the second those schools closed and doing everything in our power to get kids back, including not reopening other sectors of the economy like casinos and bars and nightclubs. We should have been prioritizing kids. Here's why it's so important to get kids back. Often we don't talk about the devastating consequences of them being out of school. Massive costs in virtual dropouts. Where I am in Boston, 10,000 high school kids didn't make contact at all in the month of May. In Philadelphia, only 50% of elementary school kids make daily contact. Kids who are on lockdown are more sedentary. They're less social. 30 million plus kids in this country rely on schools for food, so we have a food security issue. Kids who are home are more likely to suffer from abuse, neglect, exploitation, and violence. So we're not talking about those big risks of keeping kids out of school. So on balance, we put all that together, knowing we can put in these risk reduction strategies. Yes, I think kids should be going back to school in person.
There have been other countries that have opened schools, and unfortunately, it didn't work out well. I'm thinking of Israel, for instance, where they did open schools and then had to shut down thereafter. What can we learn from past mistakes in countries like that?
Yeah, I think, we have to look at a bigger picture here. You know, there is no such thing as zero risk. Will there be cases? Yeah, there will be cases. People point to the Israel example as a case study. So a couple things happen there. First, it's a country of many millions of school kids, and there are a couple hundred. And fortunately, none of those kids died. So there were cases, but none of them suffered severe adverse consequences. Two, if you look at other models across Europe, in 22 other countries, they reopened schools and did not have a problem. Same thing in Asia. So I recognize that in those countries, the underlying prevalence of cases is low. So we have to do the same thing here. At the same time, even in countries that have higher levels of cases have shown that they were able to protect kids while they were in school. And importantly, teachers. It is not an easy thing. I have kids of my own. I get it. The anxiety from teachers, parents, kids themselves. I understand this. Nothing about this is easy. We shouldn't have been here in the first place. Really, fundamentally, the reason we're here is because our country has failed since January to get a handle on this virus like other countries have successfully done.
Let's run through one of the examples that this latest opinion piece mentions to reopen schools safely. You say that it's pretty simple. People should stay home when they're sick, right? So when people start showing symptoms, they don't come in. But as we've learned, that first safeguard that you mentioned might run into some issues with asymptomatic students, right?
Yeah, it's a good question. So we use the acronym SMART, School SMART. So let me go through them quick, and I'll talk about stay home when sick. So S, stay home when sick. M, mask up. A, air cleaner in every classroom. R, refresh the indoor air. T, temporary classrooms. It's a layered defense approach. So, of course, staying home when sick is absolutely what should be happening. But we also know that asymptomatic or pre-symptomatic transmission is happening. So it's not perfect, but it does let you control a large portion of the time when people are transmitting the virus if they're sick. So now how do we deal with the asymptomatic or pre-symptomatic transmission? We have to put in these other controls. Mask up. Absolutely. Everyone should be wearing a mask in the classroom, teachers and kids at all times. Air cleaner in every classroom, the A. A portable air cleaner with a HEPA filter can give you several air changes per hour of clean air. It's plug-and-play technology, and they're not that expensive. R is refresh the indoor air. Open up those windows. Put a box fan in the window. Facilitate the movement of outdoor air indoors. And T, temporary classrooms. Can we get creative here and start having more classes outside? Can we use parks for classrooms? Can we reimagine schools entirely? I mean, look what we did for healthcare during the surge. In New York, they turned the Jacob Javits Convention Center into a hospital. Central Park had a hospital field tents. What's stopping us from doing the same thing with schools?
I want to focus on the A parts of your SMART acronym there. So the air cleaners in every classroom. And as you mentioned in your op-ed, more than 130,000 schools in our country, that puts the need at just shy of 3.5 million purifiers. Can the supply chain ramp up fast enough to make sure every classroom has these purifiers?
Yeah, it's an important question. And before I wrote the op-ed, what I did was I called all the manufacturers to get a sense of the market. And they produce about that each year, and they have the surge capacity to produce more. So it can be met. The question is there money to do it? And I estimate it's going to cost about $1 billion, which sounds like a lot of money, but not when you put it in the context of trillions of dollars in stimulus that is already going out, very small percentage actually going to schools, and not when you consider we have bailed out other industries in the past, including finance and auto. I certainly think we should have a bailout for schools and fix school infrastructure. So $1 billion sounds like a lot. It's actually not all that much money, especially when you consider what's at stake here? The learning of the kids, the health of teachers, the health of administrators, and the health of the economy. This economy is not going to get back to anything resembling any normalcy when kids are home. We see this for working parents, and particularly those people who are deemed essential workers, which primarily dominates in communities of color. And it's not right and it's not fair. And we actually can put in these control measures to keep everybody safe in school, and it doesn't cost that much money.
Perhaps you've seen this analysis from the Kaiser Family Foundation. It says 1 in 4 teachers are at high risk of getting seriously sick if they contract the virus, either because they might have some underlying condition or because of their age. So critics will say that your plan goes right out the window if there's an outbreak amid teachers and staff, and some of them, unfortunately, you know, end up in the hospital or worse, die.
Yeah, the goal here is to protect everybody in the school, absolutely. This is why the plan we have in place is 60 pages in depth. It has recommendations that we know work. They're evidence-based. You know, we're not asking the teachers to go back without protections. We have to be giving them masks. We have to put in these air cleaners or higher ventilation rates. We should do everything we can to protect the teachers. Also, we have to look at other sectors of society that we're requiring to be open. When you go to the grocery store, you expect your food to be there. So there are workers doing that. When you call 911, you expect the police or EMS or the fire department to show up. These are also people at high risk, the same age distributions as teachers. So while I understand the risk, I'm not minimizing it in any way. Schools, to me, are an essential function of society. I mean, what else is more important than we're doing in society, really, than educating our children?
That's Harvard University's Joseph Allen. He directs the university's Healthy Buildings Program. Thank you, Joseph. Appreciate the time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, King County Executive Dow Constantine got a visit last night. It was from protesters who were demanding cuts to the Seattle Police Department and an end to the youth detention. Apparently, they marched to his home, and Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott reports.
Around 200 protesters marched through the streets of Seattle last night in a nightly demonstration that has often ended up outside the homes of Seattle City Council members and is being linked to an assault on one local man just a night earlier. But last night, things seemed to stay pretty peaceful as marchers made their way to the home of King County Executive Dow Constantine, who, like some city council members, masked up and came outside to talk to the crowd. The protesters support the overall Black Lives Matter movement and are among those demanding at least 50% cuts to SPD, investments in black communities, and more, including an end to youth detention, something Constantine has said he'll help with by phasing out detentions at the new detention center within 5 years. Far too long, though, for protesters.
Where do these alternatives have to take 5 years?
Well, no, the request was made to close it in 5 years in writing, and I responded to that by saying yes. But I also said we should be able to do it sooner than that if the entire community and the judges, the prosecutor, the defender, the county council, the police, everyone cooperates in finding alternatives, even the police. And the adult and youth numbers have been declining is because we have prevailed upon the police not to bring us people who should not be taken into the criminal legal system.
No kids should be taken in whatsoever.
Constantine highlighted some of the things he's already doing to make change and including working with diversion programs like Choose 180 and community passageways to keep those in trouble out of the criminal justice system.
And we're inviting community organizations to request to be able to use space there where young people can come out of the criminal legal system, out of detention, and into a program that can surround them with support that they need, including the ability to be with their families if their family is able to help care for them.
They also brought up King County Sheriff's Detective Mike Brown, who posted a graphic cartoon of people getting hit by a car captioned "All Lives Splatter" shortly after protesters Summer Taylor and Diaz Love were run down while demonstrating on I-5 this month, killing Taylor. The crowd asked Constantine whether Detective Brown would be fired.
What about your personal security team employee member, Mike Brown, who shared All Lives Splatter? Do you have a comment on that?
That he has been placed by the sheriff on,
okay, administrative leave.
On leave. And
why aren't you firing him?
Hey,
he works for the sheriff. He works for the sheriff.
We're paying for his leave right
now.
Yeah,
I know.
Okay, well,
he works for the sheriff.
Okay, that's an issue.
And she says they are doing an expedited investigation, which will lead to whatever their conclusion is going to be. And then there will undoubtedly be lawsuits after that.
But pushed on what he thought should happen?
But you didn't really say your comment on that.
Oh, it was outrageous. And I was incredibly disappointed.
There we go. Now you have something to say about
that.
Do you think he should be terminated?
I do think that the facts support him being terminated.
Cover Radio's Hannah Scott reporting, and she joins us live. Well, it didn't seem like Constantine was upset, or at least didn't seem to mind the protesters showing up at his doorstep. What other things did they discuss?
It was actually a fairly productive conversation. He came out, he was very relaxed, and, they were kind of loud with him at sometimes, respectful but loud. And they talked about one of the questions that some asked were, how much time he spent actually out in the black communities, getting to know them, the youth, the adults, and what some of the things they deal with are, and not much. So he kept pointing to some of the programs that he has over the King County Executive's Office, kind of put out there, again, those diversion programs and some other things that he's done. And they invited him to come, spend some time and take a deeper look. They also, at the end, asked him to come today. There are multiple marches and rallies planned today. There's one at 12:30 in Rainier Beach that they asked him to come down to and make an appearance at. It's about investing in black education, I believe. And he seemed to indicate he might just do that. And in turn, he also invited the leaders of this particular group to come and meet with him at his office and take a better look at some of the efforts that he has been making.
And remind us of some of those efforts. I know you mentioned it in your piece, his plan to shut down the youth detention facility and also eventually the adults detention facility in downtown as well.
Yes, and he was clear about that adult facility that it has a lot to do with the building being really old, so there's going to need to be a place where there's obviously still some criminals who are adults that are going to need to have some sort of jail that they have to stay at. So he's really talking about getting everyone, it needs to be judges, police, everybody, as you heard him talk there, come together to deal with that and the youth situation. The other programs, though, that he's talking about is, again, the community passageways, Choose 180. These are diversion programs specifically geared towards youth to keep them out of the criminal justice program altogether. And the county has one called FERS that is also similar. So that has to do with kids that are living in difficult home situations, domestic violence type things, where you can, instead of getting them in the system, there's another way that they get them with some program managers in order to safely remove them from the home, things of that nature. And then he also talked about the inquest process, which is a kind of a complicated non-legal, it's not a criminal process. It's what happens after a police use of deadly force incident for all of them. And it's basically a way for a kind of a fact finding mission, but it's always been seen as favorable to the officers, and families never get of the people who are killed, never get what they want out of it. He really did a lot of work to overhaul that and had a lot of community input from black leaders in the community. And he was talking quite a bit about that.
And Constantine was also, he made it clear that he wants that officer who made those derogatory comments online about Summer Taylor, the protester who was hit and killed on Interstate 5, he wants that man fired. But this is up to the King County Sheriff's Office and Sheriff Mitzi Joe Hanknick. What is the latest on the investigation there?
As far as I know, it's just an internal probe that's still going on. We haven't seen the results of yet. But he said he thought that that was, from what he was hearing, was going very, very well, and they were doing a very good job. And then I think you could hear him say there, too, that once that's wrapped up, he expects lawsuits over that to be filed. And, yeah, we'll see. He doesn't have, I don't know if that he can tell her to fire that detective, but I know that pushed on it, as you heard there, that's definitely something he's on board with.
And lastly, Hannah, these demonstrators are asking for 50% cuts to the Seattle Police Department. We do expect to learn more about that effort today.
Yes, as a matter of fact, we had Shama Sawant lay out kind of her proposal, which does have, for the remaining part of 2020, 50% cuts to SPD, $85 million, I think it is. But documents that were posted overnight from the Seattle City Council for ahead of this morning's or today's budget meetings that will focus on SPD show that they have a really extensive plan, a lot of different ideas. These are amendments, so they're possibles. They have to kind of hash them out over the next few weeks. But they also had a draft resolution that essentially says, look, we're not likely going to be able to meet these demands to get 50% cuts for the rest of 2020. What we can do is lay out the groundwork for what we'll do in 2021, and they'll start work on that budget immediately after this one is resolved in the beginning of August.
That's Cover Radio's Hannah Scott. Thank you for the time, as always, Hannah.
You bet.
In the nation's northwest corner is Washington, an evergreen playground blessed by an unusual...
Our resident historian, Felix Bunnell, joins us on Friday mornings for All Over the Map, a quick look at the stories behind the names of local places. And this week, the Emerald City and other official nicknames and mottos of local communities. Felix.
Good morning, Aaron. Yeah, that name comes from a contest that was held in 1981, and the winner was announced back that summer. It was ran by the organization now known as Visit Seattle. 13,000 people sent in entries, and 425 of them said Emerald City. The winner, Sarah Sterling Franklin, they chose her entry because they liked the way she expressed the in 25 words or less, she said why Emerald City was the right choice. And so that name, you know, plays off the lush greenery, but also that home of the wizard in The Wizard of Oz. And one of my favorite little flourishes they did was they painted a yellow brick road along the pathway to the Old Kingdom not long after this, and they sort of tried to work these Wizard of Oz references into any kind of city promotions without violating any copyright of that 1939 film. And, you know, I think Emerald City was successful. It was officially adopted by the city. I'd say it's worked out pretty well. Back in 1981, tourism was not a huge business in Seattle. I found a newspaper article that said it generated about $800,000 in revenue. And if anyone listening remembers Seattle in 1981, it wasn't really a place you associated with people coming here voluntarily. But that definitely grew in the 80s and the 90s. And before the pandemic, it was a multi-billion dollar industry. I think the slogan helped, but so did construction of the convention center downtown and securing big events like the Final Four. Seattle's cultural rise in the 90s didn't hurt either. Now, earlier, perhaps as early as 1870, Seattle was justifiably known as the Queen City of the Sound and then the Queen City of the Territory. That name was never official, but it was used, and there are still some businesses and organizations, like the Queen City Yacht Club, where it persists. Back in 1913, along with an effort to name the dahlia the official flower of the city, the city council adopted the official nickname, the City Beautiful. And I don't think that ever caught on.
Yeah.
They tried again in 1946, again related to flowers, and they wanted to call it the City of Flowers. Mm-hmm. That also never really caught on. It's almost just too generic. There's another unofficial nickname for Seattle was the Jet City, for those obvious Boeing reasons. But Jet City was also used variously by Renton and Kent in the 1960s. But there are a lot of businesses. There's, you know, Jet City Espresso. There's a Jet City Improv group. Now, to the south of us here, Aaron, do you know Tacoma's motto?
I'm not going to lie to you, Felix. I do have a Wikipedia page up right now of all of our city's nicknames. I see, like, five of them on Tacoma. I'm going to go with the one I like the most, though. T-Town.
Yeah, I mean, that's I guess that's an official one. It's the City of Destiny is the one that they chose back around the 1870s to the 1880s. This is when Tacoma and Seattle were rivals to get the terminus of the Northern Pacific Railroad.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that was rigged. Northern Pacific owned most of Tacoma, and they stood to benefit from all the real estate speculation.
Mm.
Around the same time, they were trying to get the change the name of Mount Rainier to Mount Tacoma. But that City of Destiny name came from an eccentric guy named George Francis Train, and other local cities took pot shots at it and its sort of aspirational tone. My favorite's from 1888. A Spokane paper quoted a Port Townsend publication, and they said, Tacoma papers seem to be fond of speaking of that city as the City of Destiny. The Port Townsend Argus asks, Pray tell us, destined to what? Sodom and Gomorrah were cities of destiny. And around that same time, the city of Wichita, Kansas, objected to Tacoma's use of the phrase and actually threatened legal action. In 1887, the newspaper said there it was, quote, appropriated and copyrighted by the original and only real city of destiny of the West, Wichita. We hereby notify George Francis Train that further use of the words, insignia, appellation, or expression, city of destiny, in connection with the name of any other city, place, or locality other than Wichita, will be prosecuted to the full extent of the law. Don't think that ever happened. Mm. Tacoma did get the Northern Pacific Terminus, by the way, but Seattle still managed to outpace them in growth and to eventually get its own railroad connections. Now, a couple other quick notable ones. Bellevue, city in a park. Mm-hmm. Okay. Edmonds.
I mean, there's it's that an big park.
Well, yeah, there's a big park there. And it, yeah. Well, no, that's, no, in, that's no, no, that's Redmond.
Yeah.
That's in Redmond.
I'm talking about the downtown one by the mall.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, nice that's one. Part of it. There's lots of parks in Bellevue. It's not a bad I was born there. I'm not complaining. Edmonds, it's an Edmonds kind of day.
Oh, yeah. Oh. I've got a T-shirt that says that.
That could mean something good or bad, though, right? I like this one. Everett, be surprised.
What? I didn't know that. My favorite is Yakima. Do you know
Yakima? What is that? That's the Palm Springs of the Northwest.
Nice.
Palm Springs of Washington.
Of Washington. Okay. What about Marysville?
Marysville? I didn't recognize. We have the Strawberry Fest. It's called the Strawberry City. According
to this wiki. Unofficially.
Yeah, but
you can't look at wiki. It's supposed to be a contest.
Well, I'm sorry. We looked ahead.
Did you see? I don't know if this is true or not. What Bellingham? Do you know what I'm seeing on Wikipedia here? I don't know if you've heard of Bellingham's nickname, Felix.
What's I don't know that
right
one.
Now it says the city of subdued excitement. Not sure what to make of that.
Wow, I like the one that Auburn car dealers used, the Little Detroit of the West. Ooh. I don't think it was ever really official, but that's a cool. It was in a lot of advertisements back in the 70s and 80s.
And lastly, by the way, Walla Walla, the city's so nice they named it twice.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly. Now, if there's other notable slogans or family radio station friendly ideas you have for better ones, text it to us at 98973.
Felix Minnell, thank you for All Over the Map. This is Seattle's Morning News. I'm Aaron Granillo, sitting in for Dave Ross this week. We're going to debunk some myths now, thanks to Burger King. It stepped in a big controversy this month with its new ad campaign that said cow flatulence is to blame for climate change. The company had to pull the ad because it just isn't true. And not one to shy away from a story like this is Chris Sullivan. He is here to debunk much of what you think you know about cows cutting the cheese.
Yes. Wow, you're right. That was really good.
Thanks.
Way to set the table. Burger King used 13-year-old Mason Ramsey, he's a country artist, to push the cow fart myth in this ad.
And the methane from the rear goes up to the atmosphere and pollutes our planet, warming me and you.
Well, unfortunately for Burger King, most of what he sang about is wrong. First things first. The methane produced by cows comes from the front, not the back.
It really is the burps of these animals, the belching that causes the methane. That is the number one contribution of ruminant livestock, the belching.
Frank Mittlerner is an air quality specialist in the animal science department at UC Davis. Mittlerner was called in by Burger King to help it better understand how animal methane and industrial methane are quite different after this ad hit earlier this month. While the methane created by cow burps is the same chemically as the methane created by extracting oil, coal, and gas, there's a huge difference in what happens with that methane.
The carbon in this biogenic carbon cycle of a cow is just that, a cycle. It is a recycled carbon. It's not new additional carbon.
The methane created by cow burps disappears in 10 years and becomes carbon dioxide, which, of course, feeds the plants that the cows eat, and the cycle continues. The CO2 created by burning fossil fuels is a new emission, not a recycled one. And that is what most people, Mittlerner told the Ag Information Network, don't understand.
People don't understand the nuances, and even many scientists don't understand the nuances.
And that's why he says the major formulas calculating the impact of cow methane don't tell us anything about the warming impact, and that needs to change.
Methane from livestock is not just produced, it's also destroyed at almost the same rate. And this is something that's currently not being appreciated in public policy or in the public discussion of livestock's impact on the environment.
Plain and simple, in the United States, the methane produced by cows isn't the problem, nor the emissions created by raising them.
The beef sector emits 3% of all greenhouse gases. The dairy sector emits 2% of all greenhouse gases. Then there are three sectors, the transportation, energy production and use, and cement industry. These three combined emit 80%, 80, of all greenhouse gases.
Myth one, cow farts. Busted. It's the burps. Myth two, cows are largely responsible for climate change. Busted. Myth three, you will need more cows and cattle to satisfy the food needs of our planet. Mintlerner busts that one too. The industry just needs to be more efficient, he says. And developing countries need to do what California and other states have done.
We had 25 million dairy cows in the United States in 1950. Today we have 9 million. But with the 9 million today, we produce 60% more milk. And that means that the carbon footprint of a glass of milk between 1950 and today has decreased by two-thirds.
Now don't get Mintlerner wrong. He believes reducing methane and carbon emissions is certainly necessary. He just wants the focus to be on the right industries.
Instead of dealing with these mega polluters, we are dealing with cow burps, and that's just laughable.
So if you've given up meat to reduce your carbon footprint, go ahead and pick up a T-bone on the way home today and maybe a gallon of milk.
There's probably other reasons to reduce your meat intake. But
well,
I'll
I'm
take
sure
that
there
one.
Are. I mean, your doctor, and I'm sure I know there are some people that have ethical issues,
sure.
But I'm not getting, but that's what we're not here to discuss
sure,
that today. We're here to discuss it. I found the interview was fascinating.
Is he
because,
controversial among his colleagues?
No,
this
no.
Is
because
one scientist's opinion, right?
There's well, but it's growing. It's a growing trend that mm-hmm. over the last 10 years or so, people have actually started looking deeper into this instead of saying, oh, well, it's methane, and they just plug methane into their formulas and shows that this cow gas is just astronomical. But they're realizing that it doesn't work that way because it's a recycled carbon. And so there are plenty of scientists who don't believe this, but there's a growing number of scientists who do believe this is actually the way it works. And the whole idea is a lot of people have kind of vilified the beef and cow industry. Like, oh, look, they're the mm-hmm. bad thing. But meanwhile, you know, we've got other issues out there that are much more, you know, in terms of adding carbon to the atmosphere.
Yeah. This Burger King ad, by the way,
it was awful.
Has Burger King pulled that ad now?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, it was bad to begin with, in addition to how bad the information was.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it was hard to – it was a two-minute commercial. It was very, very odd.
Yeah. Thank you, Sully, for
well,
the report.
I'm here to educate and inform.
Millions of Americans right now are asking how they will pay their bills. Those expanded federal unemployment benefits expire today, and as we speak, there is no deal in Congress to continue them. We called up CBS News White House correspondent Ben Tracy for an update.
We seem to be at a complete impasse. I talked to a top White House official this morning who's involved in these negotiations, and he says he thinks it's very unlikely that they're going to reach a deal. The Democrats still want to do an overall big package while the White House is pushing for perhaps doing this piecemeal by just extending this unemployment benefit. But as of now, they have not agreed on the actual dollar amount that would be or whether or not they'll have any sort of agreement.
But what are Democrats saying about that expanded unemployment benefit plan? Because right now it's the Republicans saying they want to give workers 70% of their income as opposed to just that flat $600.
So what the Democrats want is to basically extend the current plan where it's $600 per week in a federal benefit that complements the state unemployment benefit. They want to extend that until the end of the year. The Republicans say, no, we don't want to do that because we're paying some people more money in unemployment than they were actually making at their jobs. And they view that as a disincentive to get people back to work. So they've come up with this formula where basically they want to replace 70% of their wages. But you now have states who have to, you know, who have to actually get the money out there saying this is too complicated. We don't really have a mechanism to make that happen. So now the Republican position, the White House position at least, is, OK, let's extend the benefit either at $200 or $600 for the time being until we can figure out how to make this system work. The Democrats say this is a non-starter. Let's just agree to all of this stuff at once. And they're really fixated on that $600 amount.
And as for the people who do rely on these federal unemployment benefits, they're just left waiting, essentially.
They are. Those benefits run out today. So even if by some miracle there was an agreement this afternoon, there's going to be a delay in those payments. But we're nowhere close to an agreement. And keep in mind that Congress adjourns next week for their August recess. So if this doesn't get done in the next couple of days, they don't come back until September 8th. So there could be some real pain out there for a lot of people who are already feeling it.
We should also mention the president's tweet yesterday suggesting the election this November could be delayed due to mail-in ballot fraud. He defended that tweet during a news conference later on. What was his explanation and what's been the response on Capitol Hill?
Well, he pretty much at that news conference doubled down on that, saying that he doesn't necessarily want to see a delay, but he doesn't want to see an election that he views as crooked. And he basically said, I don't want to wait for an election result and then find out that the election was meaningless. So he continues to call into question the validity of the election if there is mail-in voting. And we should point out a couple of things. First of all, there is no evidence of widespread fraud when it comes to mail-in voting. It's been done in many, many states for a long time to good effect. Also, the president has zero power to actually delay an election or cancel an election. That is something that only Congress can do. And the response on Capitol Hill yesterday was a very swift and bipartisan rebuke of this idea. You had the top Republicans come out and say, we voted during a civil war, during World War II, during the pandemic of 1917. We can get this done. So there is not going to be a delay in this election based on the factors we see now.
Let's discuss the latest news out of Portland now, where federal troops are withdrawing from the city. Oregon State Police are taking over security of that federal courthouse there. Can we safely say, though, that federal agents will not be returning there?
I don't think you can safely say that because the president yesterday said that he wants to keep some of them in place in case things go south again. So his point is if there are more attacks on federal property, mainly that federal courthouse there, the president wants people on standby that he can move back in. It's unclear if this is just kind of posturing by the president, so it doesn't look like he's fully backing down from the position they were taking. But there does seem to be an effort on both sides to kind of de-escalate this, the president kind of keeping the idea out there that we can move back in if need be.
Attorney General William Barr, he was questioned about those protests this week. He said they became violent. He defended the agents' presence there. And now we have more federal agents going to Detroit as part of the president's Operation Legend plan. Quickly, remind us what that is and how it's being received.
The administration tries to make it very clear that they see a big difference in what they were doing in Portland and what they're now doing in cities like Chicago, Detroit, Milwaukee, and others. In Portland, they were defending federal property and dealing with protesters, or as they would frame it, rioters and agitators. What they're doing in these other cities is sending an agent to complement federal agents who are already there to help try to solve and prevent violent crime. So they view these differently. These agents that they say they're sending into these other American cities are not to deal with protesters or any sort of riots that may happen. They're to help solve crimes. We'll have to see how that plays out in the next couple of weeks. You've seen local officials in these places say, we don't want this help. I think mainly because they don't really trust the motives of the federal government on this front. So we'll have to see. You know, the president, I asked the president in a briefing last week, I said, you know, you're only sending these agents into cities run by Democrats. So is this a political stunt? And he took some offense to the question. But, you know, you can't separate this from the fact that the president is currently running a campaign based on a theme of law and order. And so this very much plays into that.
I would like to end our conversation this week reflecting on the celebration of John Lewis's life. It began Sunday as his flag-draped casket crossed the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma. And then, of course, yesterday, his journey ended in Georgia. Powerful speeches from three former presidents. What was your takeaway from the week's ceremonies?
It was remarkable. I mean, John Lewis is an icon of the civil rights movement. He's somebody who remarkably lived long enough to see the fruits of his labor. You know, you had John Lewis as a young man who was somebody who was fighting for the right to vote, who gave blood, his own blood, as he was beaten after he came across that bridge and then became a congressman. So it's an amazing American story. And then I think what we saw yesterday was a reminder of what our politics has been historically and could be. You have three presidents show up to honor this man from different parties. And there was a real sense of unity there. It's striking that President Trump not only wasn't at the funeral, I don't believe he was invited, but he also did not go to Capitol Hill to pay his respects. And when he was asked if he was going to do it, he was fairly dismissive of it and just said no. So, you know, we're in a different time and a different age, but that was a nice reminder of of some of the progress that's been made in the country, even if there is much more to do.
CBS News White House correspondent Ben Tracy. And I would just like to issue just a brief correction as I was asking Ben Tracy about the protests down there in Portland. I used the word troops to describe some of the agents that were out there. There were no military forces out there. They were officers and agents from the Department of Homeland Security. Regret the error there.
It's time for your daily dose of kindness now. Sponsored by Mike Novak, enlistwithnovak.com. A seven-year-old, gave up his life savings to help the elderly during the pandemic. It's nothing to laugh at, though. Kavanaugh has saved up a whopping $500 and then started a GoFundMe page to keep it growing.
I opened up the Love is Greater Than COVID-19 community pantry because I'm just going to do this every weekend because people need what they need until coronavirus stops. I'm not giving up.
The first grader has been a force of good for a while now. His mission started with an anti-bullying message. As he describes on his GoFundMe page, after he became the target of bullies, he felt a darkness inside of him and decided he didn't want other kids to feel the same way. So, probably with the blessing of his parents, started a nonprofit called Cool Dope Living, where he has testified before his local city council, before lawmakers on anti-bullying measures, started other kindness campaigns, and is just an overall positive force. Here he is at 5 years old.
Like, seriously, yo, I got one thing to say. Don't give up. If they tell you not now, tell them, watch me work. Us troublemakers can change the world.
And now, at 7 years old, his mission is to feed people.
Hey, guys, wake up. This is serious. I need your help to help others. There are kids that may go hungry. There are senior citizens that are too afraid to go outside. So let's show the world that we have each other's backs.
His GoFundMe has now raised $17,000. You can learn more about him at coolanddope.com.
I'm trying to figure out what I was doing at 7 years old and in first grade. I was certainly not as inspiring as this kid, though.
No, I had my eye on the latest toy I wanted at seven right. years old. This is a whole new generations of kids growing up. There's a lot in school about generosity and kindness and paying it forward. I think these are lessons that our generations of parents, we're starting to pass on to our kids. Because even I see my daughter sort of hem and haw about her cash that she gets going, you know, can I give some and use some, you know, so you see that. But I wasn't doing that at seven.
No, certainly not. And now from the G and Ursula Show, weekdays 9 to noon here on Cairo Radio, we welcome in G. Scott. Good morning, G.
Good morning. Good morning. Colleen, you there?
I'm here.
Good morning, buddy. I just wanted to make sure. You got so many jobs around there, you know, Colleen, so ain't no telling what you're doing. I know you're busy.
No, I appreciate the inclusion. Hey, are you catching any of this Fauci testimony right now? It's fire. It's
No. You know why I'm not catching it?
Why?
Because it's Friday.
See.
You know what I mean? Like, it's Friday. And if there's one thing about Friday, let's be real, America, we don't really work as hard. We don't do the things. We don't like to schedule meetings. And if we do schedule a meeting, we want it to be early so we can kind of get off and just enjoy the weekend. Yeah. And that's where I'm at, Colleen. So even though I'm supposed to be working today, I'm not really working. So if you guys want to talk about baseball, let's talk about that. Yeah.
I'm actually, real quick, as a segue into baseball, I think I'm watching this testimony. I think Fauci's got a Washington Nationals face mask on, it looks like.
Yeah, didn't he throw out the first pitch?
It was an ugly first pitch, but yes, he did.
I mean, do you want Dr. Fauci to throw a good pitch? I would have a problem if he threw a good pitch. The fact that he's terrible makes me more confident that he's good at his job.
Explain.
What do you mean? Like, the dude's terrible at baseball. That means he's good at something else, right?
He's not focused on baseball. I see.
You know what I mean? I don't want him to be really good. Like, man, Dr. Fauci, you're a very good baseball player. Oh, because I spend the majority of my day throwing fastballs.
So then why did you force me to become a good high fiver?
I don't know. I don't know.
G taught me how to properly high five.
All right, let's talk. Opening day, T-Mobile Park, Mariners host Oakland. First pitch at 6:40. No fans in the stands, at least no real fans. We will see cardboard cutouts, though.
Yeah, and I'm excited about it, and maybe I'm sure that there are more people. Well, here's why. We don't know what tomorrow brings, right? Like, we don't know what's going on. We don't know what's going to be happening during this pandemic. We don't know that if in the future, if 2021, 2022, 2025, we don't know if we're ever going to see 46,000 fans in the stadium. It would be nice, but we don't know. So I'm deciding to enjoy this experience now. This is an opportunity. Like, seriously, when's the last time, you know, a lot of people have sat around with the family and watched baseball? Well, let me just speak for my household. We're not really a baseball family. You know, I mean, that's just not our thing. But it's something that I'm looking forward to doing. I mean, the pitch is going to happen. I'm also looking forward to, we got the Traeger now. You know, a lot of barbecuing going
on.
Traeger? Absolutely. Nice. You know what? Traeger is like the new CrossFit. Uh-huh. Because when people have a Traeger, they're so fast to let you know. And when people do CrossFit, they're so fast to let you know. And boy, I'm telling you, some of the good conversations that I have with people at the butcher store, I mean, it's good stuff. Oh, so who do you use? Oh, how long do you do this? And how long do you do that? I mean, the Traeger family, I guarantee you right now, somebody's texting in right now. When I said Traeger, they lit up.
Have you always been a grilling aficionado, or is this new because of the pandemic?
Back in the day, I was, and then I stopped doing it. And, well, now the new pandemic has changed me, Colleen. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I'm watching birds. Matter of fact, this weekend, I'm going to get – somebody told me that I need to get a bird bath.
Oh, bird. Sure.
I don't
yeah.
have
oh,
it.
Yeah. Love it.
I don't
love
have
it.
That. Yeah. So I'm going to get that this weekend. I watch birds in my backyard. The grass is making sure that gets taken care of. The Traeger is going to be on point. So what I'm going to do for my people – by the way, guys, I'm going camping tomorrow.
No, no. What?
Yeah, I know. Don't I know. I'm going camping tomorrow.
You have changed, my friend.
You know what I'm saying? Anyways, so tonight I'm going to do a carne asada because we're going to have tacos tomorrow night. So I'm going to getting happy, like Emeril Lagasse says, bam, getting happy on the Traeger. And so that's going to get all nice for tomorrow. But anyway, let's go back to baseball.
Well, what about basketball? Any basketball for you?
Last night I was watching them Lakers and the Clippers.
Was
oh yeah, it was fantastic. LeBron James was phenomenal towards the end. I think that you know, we appreciate the sports, and we want, and we pray that they're safe. I mean, it's unfortunate news that we just heard about with the baseball as far as the Brewers and the Cardinals. Their game has been postponed tonight because members of the Cardinals team tested positive for the coronavirus, so that's going to happen. So those type of things happen. So the Mariners playing tonight is going to be great, but the NBA was fantastic last night. Was it kind of weird not having fans? A little bit. I'm quite sure it was more weird for the players than it was for the fans viewing on TV. Right, like I'm sure that the energy in the stadium wasn't as great as it used to is for the NBA players.
Gee, I want to make sure I follow your earlier statement about baseball. You're thinking that fans will not come back like, ever?
I don't know. I mean, did you think that in March that we would be talking about fans not being in the baseball stadiums now? I mean, did you think that in July we would be talking about cases spiking around the country? I don't know. I hope so. I hope that we're going back to normal in 2021. I hope that fans are in full capacity in stadiums. I'm not trying to be negative. I'm just saying I really don't know. What do you think, guys? Do you think there's going to be 46,000 fans at T-Mobile Park next year, 2021?
I don't know about next year, but okay. I think down the road, I think we could still see packed stadiums.
That'd be great.
Yeah.
I mean, let me just say this. For years, all I talked about with my oldest son was him playing football in a packed stadium. And so the fact that he's at Ohio State, a place where there's 104,000 people that are usually in the stands when they're watching a football game. And the fact that that's not going to happen this year, it breaks my heart. Mm-hmm. So I don't want anybody to think that I am against people being in stadiums and big crowds because I look forward to that day. I'm just being realistic by saying I just don't know. And so we can all agree that it's not happening this year. Let's hope that it happens next year.
Yeah, let's hope those researchers and scientists get that vaccine right. And, it all depends on the vaccine and herd immunity, really.
And McDonald's has got to get police officers to get people to wear a mask.
Oh, is that not happening at McDonald's?
Follow that.
Wait a thought.
Okay.
See you guys.
All right, G. We'll hear you again at 9 to noon. G and Ursula.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.